Do you invest in ETFs? Whether you're thinking, what in the world is an ETF? Or you're looking for the next opportunity to add to your portfolio. GlobalX has you covered. From big tech to bonds and bars of gold, GlobalX offers a wide range of exchange-traded funds. Go beyond ordinary with GlobalX ETFs. Visit globalxetfs.com.au. That's globalxetfs.com.au.
Are you thinking about starting your wealth-creating journey, but not sure where to put your hard-earned dollars? InvestSmart can help. InvestSmart offers a free quiz that makes it easy to find the right InvestSmart ETF portfolio to help you reach your goals. Just visit investsmart.com.au and hit Get Started. Answer a few simple questions about your goals and how much you want to invest, and you'll get a tailored statement of advice with a portfolio recommendation. You can visit investsmart.com.au for a no obligations free statement of advice. This ad is brought to you by InvestSmart Advice, AFSL 334107.
Hey there, here's a quick note. This podcast contains general financial advice only. That means it's not specific to you, your needs, goals, or objectives, so don't act on the information until you've spoken with your financial advisor. You'll find our full disclosure, disclaimer, and link to our financial services guide in the show notes.
Drew Meredith, welcome to this episode of the Australian Investors Podcast.
Good to be here as always. Well prepared.
Well prepared. Yep. Shout out, Dom.
The feedback continues.
Yeah, including this comment from, this is on YouTube. This is in response to last week's episode where we talked about VDHG, and I did ask Drew to rank chocolate destinations.
No preparation for that.
UK, he brought in Switzerland. I'm pretty sure
Belgium. Swiss chocolate. Oh, Belgium. Yeah.
Belgium. Yeah. Swiss cheese, man. Ranked all the chocolate destinations and you put the Swiss US watches at the top. And this person, Sam-KQ2ZH on YouTube said, how dare you? UK chocolate is far superior. That was the only
one
comment.
One less listener. I'll send you a copy of the book when you're over.
Yeah, so Sam, now you've got a copy of Drew's book, Golden Years, How to Eat Chocolate While You're in the USA. Not really. He's got a proper title, which we'll get to in a minute.
I was paid by the Hershey family. I actually wasn't.
Like I said last week, the peanut brittle from See's Candies, really good.
I've got a Reese's Peanut Buttercup.
Oh, yeah.
Serious. And Kisses, Hershey's Kisses.
Yeah, right.
Like there's some good stuff. Maybe it's mass market, but
I don't know. It just tastes a bit like cardboard to me. No offense to anyone.
No offense to every chocolate producer in the US.
Nah, well, See's Candy, Buffett, you know, we're all friends. What have you been working on? What's been happening in the world of Waddle lately?
It's been hectic.
Hectic, I should say.
Hectic. We have, as you probably know, a lot of our investment management work goes on at the end of the quarter. So
yes, end of March.
Ticked over 31 March, so everything happening. We've done investment committee meetings, looking at asset allocations, reviewing investment opportunities and about to outline some new recommendations to all our clients. Mm. And importantly, reviewing performance.
Tell me more. Do you have the numbers or is that next week?
I was going to hold off on those numbers. But,
no. Do you have them or not?
Yeah, I've got the numbers.
Okay, yeah.
I put them into the spreadsheet.
Okay, yeah. Well, it's not formatted correctly, so I have to blink twice. Tell me more.
I mean, it's been a pretty crazy 12 months. Like if someone told you 12 months ago that the next year of returns was going to be over 10%, you probably would have thought we were crazy.
Yeah, that's crazy. So is that for a balanced portfolio?
Yeah, balanced growth has ended up at about 13% in the last 12 months.
Sheesh.
Or probably slightly over. The average, it's hard to get averages. So we know most super funds don't release for another 3 or 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. But a lot of them seem to be about 10% or so. Mm-hmm. We know it's been driven mainly by equities. So global equities and Australian mm-hmm. equities. Banking sector's gone crazy here and tech sector's gone crazy in the US. Mm-hmm. But no consistent story there. Mm. I got a little over-under for you. I'm not sure if you want to play 3 months or 12 months.
I would rather play 12 months.
12 months, all right. All right, no pressure. Best performing sector in Australia over the last 12 months.
When you say sector, you mean like on the stock market?
Yeah, GICS sector.
Oh, GICS.
So global industry.
I actually have no idea, but I would say GICS. You just said banks. I might go financials.
12 months?
12 months.
Still tech, 50%.
What?
I probably should have said a quarter. Actually, it's still tech. That's 24% in the last quarter as well.
Is that just like only WiseTech and Altium and ProMedic?
Wait, what Zero. Would be- yeah, there's like four companies. Yeah. I think, does Computershare still go in tech? I think
probably.
It does.
So you've got
REA, Carsale. No,
there's actually consumer. Some pretty good tech stocks, but
but let's say excluding that, that's probably unfair because of the tech and the AI.
Yeah, I actually didn't know. Really know. I'd say financials.
Financials was second.
Or maybe even like base metals.
Real estate was up 31%.
Really?
In the last 12 months from a very low base after
but
the
our
pandemic.
Friends just doing some Googling now.
Materials was down for the 12 months.
But our friends at the Charter Hall Long Whale REIT, CLW, ticker symbol, down 13%. Needs a bit more work.
Over the 12 months. Yeah, yeah, definitely.
But it's good leverage.
That would have been fall. That would have been much lower at the start of this period. That's what we learn about performance reporting, isn't it? That it depends on your starting point and your end point.
Yes.
And whether you annualize it or not for some people. Yes. Not far behind. So A-REITs were up 31% for the year. 10% came in the last month, 16% in the March quarter. And retail and financials or banking sector essentially were both up 21%.
Hmm. Wow.
Kind of sectors you didn't expect. We all heard about a property crash. We all heard about cost of living and no spending on retail. Mm. And they're the two sectors that rebounded the most. But we know concentration. So a great quarter from Wesfarmers, a great quarter from CBA and returns to shift. But it's moved away from mining. And this is probably...
Yeah, away from coal, away from iron ore.
Yeah, lithium's off, iron ore's off.
Yeah.
Gold's positive. I got another on my... list of topics for the week is what's happening in gold. But we always talk about the ASX hitting all-time highs over, I think, 7,900. But it's done it while materials, which represents, I think, probably 25%, has fallen in 12 months. So this is why having an index or passive core can still be worthwhile because not every company is going up at the same time.
Yeah, we'll chat to someone during the week about this actually and how a lot of people think the Aussie market is like devoid of growth. Which is totally not the case. It's the second best performing stock market over the ultra long term of any in the world. The only one who beats
An ultra marathon, 100 years?
Yes. Yeah. do you know, have a guess which stock market beats the Australian market over the last, say, 200 years or 150 years?
Zimbabwe.
Yeah, if it's in whatever their currency was before hyperinflation. No, I don't know. No, it's South Africa.
Yep. No, I wasn't far. Actually,
Yeah, same continent.
It's a neighboring. Well, credit to me.
Credit to you, sir. So, South Africa, Australia, the US was basically the order. But if you bring it back to 50 years, the US is like the closer you bring it back to today, the US is winning.
And you said there's a bit of a risk difference there too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I think that's really an important reminder. And one of the points that we're making when we're speaking to an investor this week was that even if you look at the Aussie market, some of the things that aren't captured in return terms. So when, I don't know how I'm assuming you're using total returns, of course, but one of the things that people don't really think about is if you're an accumulator or a retiree and you get franking credits, there is a franking credit adjusted index in Australia.
Yeah.
People don't really know that. They just go by the XJ or ASX 200 or the All Ords, which is most often not including dividends at all, let alone franking credits. And if you think about the after-tax free kick you get from franking credits, the Aussie market, you could probably add, 1 or 2%,
definitely,
say 1% to the long-term return because of the tax effective nature of the Aussie market. So all things considered, Aussie market is punching above its weight still.
Yeah, and fits well into a diversified portfolio.
Absolutely.
We say, as you did say that we're not absent of growth, but we do see Australia as being a more value and cyclical equity market that you can blend well. That means it blends well with more growth oriented US consumer and tech companies. So
I think the problem with Australia is for most investment managers, like say us, because we're predominantly just investing in ETFs, there aren't that many great listed products for the growth side of the Australian market. So what I mean by that is like there's not that many small cap options. Like if you look at
an active one too.
Yeah. If you look at a small cap ETF in Australia, which we don't invest in any, it's underperformed the ASX 200 by a long way. Because the indices for that are pretty horrible.
momentum tends to drive those indices. They get rebalanced, they get bigger.
Yeah, they go out, they go into the ASX 300 or 200. That's why we use the VAS ETF, VAS, as opposed to ASX 200. So it catches a bit more of the smaller companies. Doesn't really make that much of a difference. Yeah. But
that's why we use the opposite.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a bit of a, you know, you tend to get the ASX 200 outperforming by about 20 basis points.
Yeah.
Which is 0.2% for those of you that aren't nerds like us. And so the impact of choosing ASX 200 or 300 is really meh.
Limited, yeah.
Yeah, there's not much going on there. But I think one of the advantages that financial planners like yourself have is that you can allocate to small cap fundies through your platforms and through, like, I don't know what you use, Hub, Netwealth, whatever you use.
Yeah, CFS.
CFS, yeah. You can allocate to small cap fund managers, get active share. In a big way.
So. Definitely. And particularly that sector is, that sector, I mean, small caps are one sector where active managers tend, more than 50% of active managers tend to outperform over the long term.
Yeah.
And probably the ultra long term, but I'm not sure what ultra long term is. So.
But that's fair enough. Like, a lot of people throw those active versus passive Spiva things at people. And sure. If you're picking top blue chip stocks in Australia, you're probably not going to be able to outperform consistently over the long term. Some do. Yeah. But most, you're better off just being passive. Same with US mega caps, but you're just better off being passive. But if you go further down or into other markets, active does win in some areas.
Definitely, and private markets.
Yeah, private markets, you have to, right? Yeah. So, yeah, you don't want passive.
Got a dark horse question for you here.
Dark horse.
Who is the little dark horse benchmark that smashed the NASDAQ this year?
As in, like, a benchmark?
Are you saying an index.
Country. Smashed.
Country.
A whole country. Oh, yeah. Japan.
Yeah.
I didn't even know. Is that
well
the answer?
Done. Well done.
Because we've talked about it a little bit, but Japan, for the first time in 30 years, is it's like it's woken up.
It's there's a lot changing.
Everyone's like, whoa, hello.
41% from the Nikkei last year.
Wow. That's good for the central bank, given that they own so much of it.
Well, there's news there too. They finally, after 8 years, they're not doing negative interest rates anymore.
Yeah,
they moved from negative 0.1 to zero. To zero to 0.1, which, if you think about it, is a 100% change. That's a 100% increase.
Yeah, well, I often think about that. Like,
it's inflation.
If you're coming off zero, it's almost infinity. Yeah.
It's been like, and they've talked about this story a lot. Platinum has been a big proponent. So they run a Japan fund that's been around forever.
Yeah.
But they've always talked about, one, the unique economic structure in Japan, I think, is low in immigration and very high levels of employment. But more recently, it's about the incredible change occurring. There's a lot of conglomerates. There's a lot of businesses that are involved in retail and semiconductors and electronics. And there's more focus on releasing shareholder value. So, demergers, company restructurings are becoming kind of incentivized by government. So, modernizing that economy.
Yeah, it's
Bill Mitchell would be happy.
He would be. Yeah, I wonder if he's an investor there as well. People who invest in the VGS ETF from Vanguard or the All World, maybe IOU get a bit of exposure as well, but global investors will get exposure to Japan as part of their diversification. But
I think it's one of the fifth largest economy in the world.
Is that right? I don't know the exact number, but yeah, it would. Well, you'd have. Let's just play a bit of trivia. Someone can catch us out here. So we don't have any tools in front of us. I'm going to say USA. Europe, China.
You can't put Europe, can you?
Well, it's a block. They always measure it as a block. So I'm going to say USA, Europe, China, Germany, Japan.
Yep, I agree.
Okay, let's have a look. while I'm doing this.
No one else goes in there? No. I'd take Europe out and then you increase someone.
Yeah, okay.
Probably, I don't think South Korea would be big enough.
Whoa.
India would be sixth.
Okay, so this list that I've just caught from unnamed source is... United States GDP nominal of $25 trillion. So that's number one.
How many zeros is that?
That's a lot. China, 18 trillion. So they didn't put the block in, obviously. They just, whatever. Japan at three, then Germany, then India.
Yes.
Interesting.
So we're both right.
We're always right.
Depends where you go. If you go on Wikipedia, it'll show, or Trading Economics, I think it'll show Japan as like the fourth or fifth biggest, but depends what we're measuring on.
Yeah, right. It's interesting. It's how, obviously this one thing that people should know is the stock market's not the economy.
Yeah.
So the Chinese economy has done very well over the past 5 years, but the stock market as a whole has been pretty...
basically zero.
Yeah, yeah. It's been very weak. Japan, obviously, we mentioned before, up until probably 24 months ago, had done nothing. And it's because they had a lot of those conglomerates, that what we would call conglomerates, which would refuse to be broken up.
Yeah.
I can't remember the name for them. There's actually a Japanese name for them, isn't there?
I mean, Warren Buffett invested in a heap of the broking houses.
Yeah.
From memory. Yeah. It's a colloquial name for...
I'll figure it out before I ask this next, before you answer this next question, which is you've got in your notes here for this week, you've got catch-up contributions. Tell me more.
Oh, this is a good question.
Yes.
For some reason, there's this thought that these end this year. But so catch-up contributions relate to your ability to contribute to super. There's two types of contributions. One is concessional, which is before tax, can be included salary sacrifice, and after-tax contributions that you can claim a deduction on.
Mm-hmm.
This refers to those concessional contributions, and basically you can use the last 5 years of your concessional contribution cap in any given year if you didn't use it all. So if the limit was $27,500 for the last 4 years and you only contributed $17,500.
So $10,000 left over each year.
Then you could make a significant contribution of $50,000 above, which is technically above this year's cap, and also claim a tax deduction on that $50,000. So this is a massive strategy that, particularly for people getting close to retirement or where the balance between a husband and wife or partners.
Yep.
Is uneven. It's a way to top up that balance, but can also be used. So those tax deductions can be used to reduce your taxable income and deal with capital gains, realized capital gains, which we're seeing a lot at the moment.
So someone puts money in for them and their partner, they claim a tax deduction. Like they wouldn't claim on their partners.
You'll pay contributions tax at 15% on these type of contributions, but you get a dollar for dollar tax deduction for every dollar.
Yep.
So the net benefit can be significant if you're on a marginal tax rate above their contributions tax rate.
And then there are other things like the downsizer contribution for over 55s.
Yes, that's a way to...
300 grand each.
Non-tax contributions, so non-concessional contributions, where you each partner, I think it's now, if you hold a property for 10 years and you contribute the funds within 3 months of settlement, you can get an extra $300,000 each outside of their caps into superannuation.
So it's huge, huge, huge opportunities for people. This is what we've always said, is like financial planning in the lead up to retirement and in retirement is just, that's when the financial planners go to work.
I had a good question today, which was how do you ascertain or measure the value of the advice you're giving? And like, as we've talked in the past, there's simple things like tax deductions, tax savings, investment returns, which a lot of it's connected to that, but a lot of our psychology is connected to investment returns, but that's such a small part.
Yep.
And then the less quantifiable parts.
Yeah.
Like chocolate decisions.
Chocolate decisions. Don't take that from Drew, by the sounds of it. What
can
else?
Can we put that one down to Andrew and say it was Andrew that made that call?
Yeah, I'll reply to that person. Actually, I did reply to them in YouTube. I normally Kate handles that, but I took liberties today.
I thought something different was happening.
I did say, I know, right? I'm still in shock that Drew said this. Clearly, he has no taste buds. so just brunt of the joke.
I'm just looking for a sponsorship.
Yeah, Hershey's are going to ride in. If we're not here next week, you know it's because we have the Hershey's. what else is making news?
Big thing this week was we had another asset class hit an all-time high. Probably highly unexpected, not Bitcoin. Sorry.
That's an asset class?
Sit down over there. What would they call this? They call Bitcoin digital gold. They call this physical gold.
Oh, right.
And it's gold.
Interesting. Unhedged gold, you say?
Both.
Hedged and unhedged. Yeah. Interesting.
So okay. I think hit an all-time high in US dollars of $2,257 bucks during the week.
Wow.
Which is quite rare, and tell me if you've seen it before, where you can have like equity market benchmarks all over the world, gold bullion and numerous other asset classes all at all-time highs.
Yeah. It's interesting. We moved out of gold in the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
Because I didn't expect this was going to happen.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't normally happen. There's no geopolitical events.
You can get income from your cash now.
Yeah. I don't see the purpose.
I think part of it's this hedge away from shares.
Yeah.
Not that they're selling shares, but they're instead of adding it elsewhere, people are probably just worried about bonds in the short term, but they're just allocating it to gold as opposed to you know, everyone talk about everything at all-time highs. So where do you allocate it?
Yeah.
That seems to be a driver. But all the media always goes geopolitical is increasing. Something might happen in the Middle East. It's always that seems to be what they put the reasoning down to. But I think it's much more nuanced than that.
Yeah. I made a joke last week or a quip about people on average are getting taller. But it's true because a lot of the numbers that we see, like markets at record highs, you expect more money in the system because we've been printing money, globalization, the developed economies, you know, we all have money in circulation now.
Yeah.
And so these assets, this capital needs to find a home. So when there's a scarce resource like gold, you'd expect that people would be pushing up prices.
Definitely.
Particularly because gold is becoming harder to mine. Sounds like Bitcoin, but it's becoming harder to mine. So
they're going to split half the gold or something too.
Yeah, they're going to split it. Value. And then that's just going to be a catalyst. And BlackRock said they're going to do something. Then this guy over there's like a CEO, he has like laser eyes. She said something.
25% allocation. No, you do not. An interesting one is I had a couple of, it was down in Mornington Peninsula over the weekend.
Ah,
and they're
sipping a Pinot, were you? Go on.
Not to brag. but the amount of for sale signs going up everywhere.
Oh, crazy.
I'm not sure if it's it doesn't feel the same in Melbourne where I am, that there's that many houses going for sale.
Yeah.
But then I started looking into it today, which is kind of changes in land tax and everything that's happening there.
Yeah, yeah. So, I don't know if I've told you this, but I've been looking to buy a house down there.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're a regular listener of the Australian Investors Podcast. But we're considering buying a house down there. And it's just
moving commute or?
Well, it'd be a hell of a commute, wouldn't it? For those of you that don't know, it'd probably be what? In traffic, an hour and a half to the city?
Yeah, but it can take you an hour to go 8 kilometres in Melbourne. So an hour and a half from beachside isn't bad.
Yeah, down on the beach. Yeah, it's any of those areas where it's awkward to get to the city or-
The price is going
to
go up now that you've told everyone you're buying down
everyone
there.
Yeah, everyone buying Mornington. But it's a wonderful part of the world, and especially for Victorians who do like the beach. We do have them, guys, in other states and gals. We do have beaches. It's a wonderful part of the world. But I put it down to a lot of those properties in those regions have really shot through the roof.
Yeah, and in a short period of time.
We're talking $2 million properties for people's context, maybe $1 to $2 million in that range, which as a holiday home, and they're typically bigger blocks down that way, you're going to get a lot of land tax. You're going to be paying $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year in land tax.
And we put in the vacant land tax.
Yeah.
Oh, so now if your house is vacant
and
there's different definitions of vacant, then you then have to, in addition to your normal land tax, you have to pay either 1, 2, or 3% of the capital improved value. So land tax was historically on the land.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Hence why it's a land tax. Duh. That was me talking to myself.
That was Andrew just coming through, trying to break through, kind of like the Hulk. He's just like breaking out of Drew's skin.
But now you're paying an extra 1, 2, or 3, and it increases each year that it's untenanted on the capital improved value, so the assessed value of your house. And then from 1 January 2025, it's not no longer limited to, I think, 10 council areas, but all of Victoria.
Yeah.
So this is why, and speaking to a few people, this seems like one of the reasons that there's so much going on the market at the moment.
I was at one of your clients' 60th birthdays the other day, actually, and who shall remain nameless, and land tax was the topic.
I'm pretty sure I know who that is.
Land tax.
Which clients do you know? Oh, yeah.
Land tax was the topic.
Yeah.
It's kind of like you walk into a room like, yeah, this guy works in finance. Oh, land tax.
No, so we do equities, mate.
Yeah, cheers. It's ETFs over this side of the fence. But I actually think like it's actually a great catalyst for older people who, particularly older people, but everyone, who have historically favored property over shares. I think this is a massive catalyst to get people into the share market. And I honestly believe it's easier than ever thanks to ETFs. You know, just it's so much easier. It's not a – you don't – well, yeah, I've got some horror stories. But it's easier than ever to invest in a diversified way and get franking credits, get dividends, make a 4 or 5% return from a diversified portfolio just in the income side, let alone the growth as you mentioned before.
Yeah.
And I think that's a game changer from 10 or 20 years ago when everyone was just hoiking into property.
And the amount of people coming in that are, you know, have multiple properties or they're now getting less than 1% after interest after land tax, then
They'd be lucky to get that, honestly.
You've got to be very hopeful about capital growth from there.
Yeah. We actually had aired an episode with Pete Wargent this week on the show, and he talked about that, how, I mean, residential property is not about that. Yeah. Residential property is not about income. I've spoken to a few really savvy investors that have multi-tenanted homes. So it looks like a Metricon home or a whatever home from the front, but actually inside there might be like six or seven different tenants that share some communal assets, but most of it's an individual tenanted area with a kitchenette and whatever. And those can work. Those can work, particularly towards like Brisbane areas. But the reality is that residential property is not a good income source in my opinion.
No. In most cases, no.
Yeah. And even if, and we've got a good question, we'll jump to questions in just a sec, Drew, but we've got some really good questions on this, because unless it's fully paid off, it's not getting that much passive income. Before we get to questions, anything else?
I had a hypothetical.
Okay, go.
Favorite flavor of kombucha?
Well, yeah, I'll just go the original. What's the original? The pink one? What's that? That's original.
Raspberry lemonade.
Is it raspberry lemonade? That's one. Yeah. What about you?
Mango passion.
Wow. People, we need your opinion on this. I think this could go either way, but kombucha is really interesting. I wasn't on the whole fad thing earlier on, but then I started to follow this health guru, don't we all? And the idea that it doesn't have any sugar is really interesting.
There's so many options not to drink sugar these days.
Yeah. It doesn't have any sugar and it's meant to be good for your gut health.
Yeah.
Which is rare that you would enjoy something that's good for you. I had an appointment with a dietitian not too long ago, and then I had to go see a specialist about something, and he's like, "You can't drink fizzy drinks." I'm like, "We're back in butchery." He's like, "No." I'm like, "Okay, back to the sauerkraut." And he's like, "Actually, don't have much of that either." Anyway, we've got some questions sent through. You can send a question through by clicking the thing that says "Ask a Question." It's in your show notes if you're on Spotify or Apple or wherever you listen, or on YouTube. Look below the video. We did have a question come through on YouTube. The question was, where do I ask a question? You can head to any of the RASC websites, for example, raskmedia.com.au. In the menu, you'll see something that says questions. Select the Australian Investors podcast for Drew and I. Or if you want to get a property answer or whatever, go select one of the other channels. The key thing is, we don't know your personal circumstances. And as much as people love to send us in a story, it's really important that you ask your question in a strategic way, because we are legally bound not to give you personal financial advice. We can only give general financial advice. That means we don't know your needs, goals, circumstances, or objectives. So speak to a licensed financial planner who can help you out. There is also a link in your podcast player to get financial planning advice, no matter what stage of life you're in, whether you're younger, whether you're in the regular size cappuccino, or you're a slightly more fuller individual, you can get financial planning there, or you can email drew@wattlepartners.com.au. That's Drew Meredith. Drew and the team at Wattle Partners specialize in retirement, particularly people with slightly larger balances. So keep that in mind. If you're looking for someone else, you might want to head to the link in your show notes, and it will ask you some questions and it will automatically match you with a financial planner. But you can email Drew directly as well, and he can help you out. So this person is, I don't know if this is the same person, but the first two questions come from folks who I think have asked questions before. We don't know, because we asked you for a funny answer. But the Baron Wuffett of Brighton, so Brighton's a place in many Australian states, could be Brighton in Adelaide, it could be Brighton in Melbourne, it could be Brighton, who knows where. We're in the late 40s, have paid off our principal place of residence and plan to reduce our salary in the next few years. We're looking to buy the right property for us in retirement, but concerned that the reduced income will impact our ability to get a mortgage. We have a sizable $1 million amount in non-superannuation shares, but prefer not to use that, as well as a similar amount in super, which we cannot touch until 60. What are some tactics people could use as a workaround, the potential constraint of the mortgage? We understand that this is not financial advice and any comment is general in nature. So I will just generalize this once again to say, someone is looking to get a mortgage later on in life. When I say later on, I don't mean much later on in life.
Late 40s, it's not.
Yeah.
What are you saying?
But what I mean is, like, most people, when they get a mortgage, they view it with like 30 years. They're getting it in their 30s and whatever. They're increasing their income typically over time, or at least, you know, one of the breadwinners has a view to increase income. This person is the opposite.
Yeah.
They're thinking, we've already got enough money. We don't want to use that. And our incomes are going to reduce. How do you deal with something like that?
There's two questions. I mean, in my head, two questions come up. One would be, do you need to do this? So if you're in a strong financial position and you're adding leverage to your situation, it'll significantly reduce your flexibility.
Yeah.
You will have to continue to generate some sort of income to service that. And that's my first thing is, are you taking more risk than you need to?
Yep.
The second part would be, actually, I think I had a good conversation. I mean, I know I had a good conversation. I can't remember who I had that conversation with. And it was-
It wasn't the Baron Warren.
It was this idea that everyone says how hard it is to get a mortgage when you're retired or most of your income doesn't come from salary anymore.
Yep.
But they were saying that you were probably explaining it, that it is actually, you need a good mortgage broker because you have to actually sell that story to the lender.
Yeah.
You have to paint the whole picture rather than just say, here's the income that comes from shares. So that would be the second one, which is find a mortgage broker. Yeah, that knows how to do this. And the other one is, which isn't advice, there's a whole group of lenders that aren't as limited in scope, would be the word, that the big four banks are.
Yeah.
Like there's so many non-bank lenders out there now.
Yeah, you pay a little bit more in interest typically. But
and they support people that aren't on PAYG salary. So, you know, people that run their own businesses would be, hopefully I've added an extra question to it.
Yeah, it's interesting because if I was in this situation, what would I do? I probably wouldn't be in a rush to get a mortgage. I'd say see a good mortgage broker. There's a link for one of those in the show notes as well, by the way. Mortgage broker Chris Bates and the team at Flint. One of the things that I think about with this is I wonder if the mortgage broker might be able to help insofar as giving you advice of whether to buy first, then refinance.
Yeah.
So you already have the security over the property.
Yeah.
And then you might be able to redraw a smaller amount, but the bank already knows you have security.
So use the shares that you've got to...
I was going to say the opposite. They don't want to sell shares to crystallize taxable gains, but I don't know, you could almost cop that and buy the property in cash and then reverse onto a finance situation. It's a bit technical, but a good mortgage broker can help you out in this situation. It does reduce your ability to borrow at the same rate, like the ratio of everyone loves a PAYG. If you work in healthcare or you work for the government and you've got a good PAYG, you'll get lots of lending on that. But if you rely on passive income from like shares or something, obviously they're not going to let, they might lend you something, but it won't be at the same quantum. Like they won't lend you four times your income. They might lend you two, for example, or something like that. And you probably need a bigger deposit. So get a good mortgage broker on your side. And as Drew said, go back to first principles. Do you actually need to do this? Now, this person has definitely sent in a question before, unless someone else has imitated their name. Spreadsheet Junkie writes in and says, I am 10 years out from my planned retirement age and thinking of selling an investment property. Hello. We've got a lot of questions on this. To give my super a turbocharge, I have crunched the numbers and unless capital growth in the property was exceptional, putting money into my current high growth super option is going to win comfortably. Was thinking of putting in $110,000 this financial year and $360,000 next financial year using the bring it forward non-concessional contributions. I'm already maxing out the other one, which is the concessional that Drew spoke about. I don't want to try and time the market, but I'm interested in your thoughts on implementing a big lump sum strategy like this when the market is sitting at all-time highs. I could also park the money in my offset account, so effectively on 6%, and regularly contribute over the next, say, 24 months to better dollar cost average. What I'm going to say here, Drew, there's a bit of too much information here.
Yeah.
What I'm going to say is there's an option. This is the kind of conversation that we had last week. I didn't preempt this question, but last week I did ask you, how would you go about transitioning from property into super? We already mentioned the-
Bring forward, catch up.
Bring forward.
So that would be one thing to think about here as well.
Yep. Why did they say $110,000?
So the non-concessional contribution cap, which is not tax deductible and not salary sacrifice, super guarantee. Yeah, exactly. That cap is set at four times the concessional contribution cap. So 27,500 times four is 110,000.
Yep.
And that is set to increase to, so one is going to 30, the other is going to 120.
Yep.
And the bring forward rules allow you to bring forward two future years of contributions, non-concessional, into the current financial year, but you can't use them again.
So 360. So
that's where your 110 and 360 come together.
So just to confirm for people, from 1 July 2024, that's a new financial year. The rules will change slightly. They'll be in your favor. You'll be able to put $30,000 of concessional and $120,000 of non-concessional. But there are rules, such as this person has figured out.
Conditions of release.
Yes. Yep. And make sure that there are risks to all this stuff, by the way, but make sure you get financial planning advice on this because you've got to do it in a particular way often. So you don't want to bugger that up on the way in.
It's and not why would you do it? You do it because superannuation is essentially tax-free up to balances, which will eventually be $1.9 million per person once you hit retirement and once you start drawing a pension after 60.
Yep.
That's why you want to you generally want to maximize your super balance.
Yep. The other aspect of this is this person has rightly, I think, figured out that if you have an unleveraged property, you're better off parking that money in super than you are keeping it keeping it outside in a property. So what I mean by that is rather than have one investment in a four-bedroom house in XYZ suburb that has no debt on it, earning you
3%,
plus you got all the costs, you're better off just taking selling it and putting it all in as much as you can into super because at least you'll get franking credits, at least you'll get growth, at least you don't have to manage it, you know, all these things. And it's not taxed as highly because it's
diversified.
15% tax. Yep. You've got more than one thing that you're relying on. It's such a better decision.
Yeah. I think I'm always wary when someone says, has certainty around the returns though. Unless I get exceptional capital growth from the property, super will smash it. There are periods where investment markets go sideways. So it's always balancing.
Yeah.
But by and large, at different points in time, we know that a portfolio of shares can actually change and evolve, whereas a property is going to be subject to a few key inputs, which will be what interest rates do and how the economy is traveling.
Yeah. And this, I think this person has, they do say in their name that they are advanced spreadsheets. So it seems like they have gone into this with their eyes open. They're not one of those people that are chasing 20% returns or something like that. They, I think, would appreciate that. But that's a very valid point. You know, Drew, the number one people that lined up to invest with us for Rask Invest is people in this group. I did not expect that. I did not expect people that would be in this situation.
So more people, selling
properties
and assets
and trying to find another way to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's just so much more flexible. I'm not saying don't do residential property, but it does lock you into a strategy and it's a long-term strategy.
A lot of frictional costs.
Things can change quickly and equities, we know you only need to look at the Apples and Microsofts, Westfar, all these companies that we talk about and their potential to keep evolving and growing and they're incentivized to do that.
Yeah. And the second part of that question was buying at a market high, and that ties in with the next question. So we'll jump straight to that. And the question a name, Drew, was an interesting one. The question a name is, what a great question.
Presumptuous.
If a share is at an all-time high price, is it worth waiting for it to drop, knowing historically prices go up and down? And what we can do here is we can answer this from both the perspective of the market. So let's say, for example, the Australian market is at an all-time high. Should we wait? And then we can say from a stock perspective, if a stock is high, should we wait? Because I think they're slightly
Well done, well done there.
Two different answers. So
they're saying, are you assuming they want to sell it? They're wanting it to drop to sell it? Or
I think I'm assuming they want to buy it.
Oh, I always naturally go to sell. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm assuming that because they're waiting for it to drop.
I mean, I'm still waiting for zero share price to drop back to $50, but it's not going to happen.
Every day I get a new reminder from Stocklight, which is an app that I have on my phone that tracks share prices, and it sends me an alert. Where's my one from today? It sent me one today saying Pro Medicus all-time high.
Oh, thanks.
Zero, all-time high. Altium, all-time high.
Sorry, money bags.
Thanks, guys.
That's what we call confirmation bias, people.
Yeah, just feedback loops from your
all-time low. Is Dubba's all-time low in there? Sorry, that was...
Where is Dubba going? Let's have a check-in.
No, let's have a check-in.
But anyway, it doesn't show up in Google anymore. So for you,
there's two.
You answer this from the
two camps on this.
Okay, go for it.
There's when you're deploying a big chunk. You assume you want me to go to the big chunk of capital.
Yes. Yep.
And there's two schools of thought. And to me, this comes down to where the value of advice can come from, which is identifying the kind of person you are and the way you the emotional involvement you have in investing. For people who are less comfortable, haven't had as much experience, and not necessarily comfortable with volatility, then a dollar cost averaging, it's not really dollar cost averaging because you're doing it over a short period of time, but a strategy in which you're buying small parcels of all the different investments, new investments, not just buy one, some of ANZ and some of BHP, actually buying a little bit of everything over that period makes sense for people who aren't comfortable with volatility and risk. But to be honest, the way we tend to do it as a default would be you're building a highly diversified portfolio. We're not just buying the ASX 200. We're buying a lot. We're buying some of that. We're also buying a lot of sectors and areas of the market and all different markets that are undervalued. So you'll have some bonds, you'll have some gold, you'll have some private markets or private equity. So we're more than comfortable within the research and the work we've done that allocating that at the same time won't leave you worse off than the alternative. But a lot comes down to that emotional side.
Yeah, it's got to be the emotional side in my opinion. But yeah, see, the problem is, Drew, when most people put money into investing, what they think about is they go, I'm going to put it into the stock market. A lot of people don't think about, I've got some bonds in there, I've got some gold in there, I've got some this and that and some this and that. If you did that, it would make a lot of sense that you could drop a lot of money in. There's really no constraint on that, by the way. A lot of the ETF providers would like you, if you go down the ETF route, a lot of them would like you to break it up, not say, don't just go and put one bid in at $1 million, maybe do four and do it over a couple of days or something like that. But yeah, I mean, I'm in the camp that if I had a big balance, I would break it up over months at least, if not a couple of years, depending on how experienced I was at investing. And even if I had never invested before, I'd probably want to go play like the ASX share market game or do something like that.
They still do that?
Yeah, they do. Yeah. It's probably a bit short in terms of the time horizon.
Smash that these days.
Oh, yeah. You would be all over that, mate. You'd be able to pick some really good winners. That was Andrew Derriman speaking, by the way. And then the other thing is about picking individual companies. I think that my thought process has evolved on this over the years. I teach the Value Investor Program, so there's that. So I know how to value companies fundamentally. I know how to value businesses, but that's not to say that I rely on that as the only thing that I do when I invest in a business. Nowadays, I'm more inclined, because I use the core and the satellite approach, got like most of my money in my core ETFs through Rask Invest. Because I've got that, with the satellite positions that I have, which say might be 20% or 10% of my money, I'm much more likely to, was that swing for the
fences? Swing for the fences.
Yeah. I'm much more likely to, I probably won't go all in on WiseTech at current prices, for example. But I would be prepared if I was going to, let's say hypothetically, I was going to chuck $5,000 or $10,000 into something like that. I would be prepared to buy $1,000 today regardless of the price.
Yeah.
And then I would use that as an incentive to keep researching it, keep following it, and then put an extra few grand in a few months. And then if it falls, go even harder into it. But the reason I would do that is because oftentimes, as you alluded to, Drew, with your little remark, which is very apt, which is that sometimes you're left waiting forever.
Yeah.
And you never get a chance to buy the best businesses because they always look cheap. They do fall, absolutely. But oftentimes it's better just to buy. Sometimes you can't buy low, sell high. In fact, I hate that. Just buy and then buy again.
And sometimes when they do fall, you don't want them anymore.
Well, that's it. They've fallen for a reason. Yeah. So I would say there's probably like 30 to 40 really, really, really good companies in Australia. And it's not a secret that they're really, really, really good. We didn't talk about it, but ResMed was something that you had in your notes.
Yeah.
That was a very rare exception last year when one of the best companies in Australia was sold down over fears of Ozempic. That was a clear opportunity to buy some shares at a cheap valuation. You don't often get good and cheap as much as the marketing would teach you that. Oftentimes, you get good and fairly priced.
And it's still off a bit too.
Yeah, I think ResMed's one of the best businesses.
$34. So they produce like CPAP machines and
sleep apnea.
Essentially, I think their goal is to help people live better, more fulfilling lives by helping them breathe easier and deal with, you know, medical treatments.
I think it's one of the really, really, really good businesses on the ASX.
60% of the market between them and Philips.
Wonderful business. And that was cheap for a little while and people could have bought it and they were too scared about Ozempic. We wrote about it for our members. I actually didn't buy any because I was waiting to put my money into all the ETFs. But I would have if I had that chance again. I would have, obviously. I don't know what this next one is. Life on our own terms at 50. Life all on one word. 50. No, it took some untangling. chasing some general thoughts. If a couple had no debt and enough cash to be very helpful in their and enough cash that would be very helpful in their 50s, very much subsidizing the need for full-time work, ignoring super, hypothetically, it's on an ideal trajectory. Besides term deposits, where else could this cash be placed to give it a lower risk bang for buck to subsidize income for people in their 50s? Term deposits?
Term deposits aren't bad.
We could do
4% now. So we separate at the highest level assets into two different types, defensive and growth. Mm-hmm. Defensive provides more income. Within defensive, we see it in two ways. You've got cash and term deposits. That's put that to the side. That's government guaranteed. Then you see it as fixed rate or floating rate, fixed interest. And the name comes from the fact that you're basically lending a company or country or someone money and you're getting paid interest, fixed rate of interest in return. That rate of interest can float or be variable like a loan. It's getting a long way around to the answer. But there's a massive range of opportunities and it just depends on what sort of income you're looking for and what sort of risk you're comfortable with. So at the bottom level, you can buy Australian government bonds or US government bonds, and they're offering you an income of about 4%. So slightly in line with term deposits. Mm-hmm. The difference being that when your term deposit matures, you'll have to, you know, get a new rate, whereas the yield you're buying from those bonds will sustain for an extended period of time. Then you step out and the more risk you take-
Bonds can also go up and down a little bit.
They can change in value. Then you step from there and you go into corporate bonds, so loans to companies, could be to Woolworths, to Wesfarmers, and then you get a slightly higher income in return for that. Then you can go into what is known as credit, similar to corporate bonds, but this all comes down to credit ratings. It's probably a bit too detailed for this single episode. But it basically comes to the fact that a credit rating is there to measure the risk of default of a company not being able to repay the money that you lend to them. Yep. So naturally, the lower the credit rating, the higher income or return you should receive.
Yep.
You should be expecting to receive.
So ballpark figures from a credit portfolio, like a credit
7%.
You probably go on the lower risk, maybe 6% up to 10% for much higher risk.
So you go a very low risk at 4% in government bonds.
Yep.
And then you talked to Invesco recently on senior secured. I think that's like 9.9%.
Yeah.
That's secured by assets or company assets.
In the US.
Yep. It just investment grade credit is about 6 or 7% income at the moment.
So blending all these together, if someone, let's bring this back. So someone should always have cash if they're needing money in the next 2 years.
For an emergency requirement.
You always need cash, but fortunately that cash can now pay something, which is great. You wouldn't put it in an offset even like this person suggested that they just free. But I think that what you're touching on is that you can build a diversified portfolio and get 4 to 6% per annum.
Yeah, exactly. It used to be the fact
and
that
it can grow.
Your equity allocation would dominate your income. Now it's gone the opposite. Yeah. Your equities are yielding less than your fixed income.
Yeah.
So now you can
do that. And for anyone that is in a wonderful situation where they are debt free and they're building up their cash balance, we don't go too much specifics, but we've got someone investing with us that is in a similar life stage, except they have traditionally relied on property. This sounds like a big beat up on property. Love property, guys. This is just—it just so happens that all of the questions that we received in the last 24 hours were these ones. So, and that's not an indication of how to get your question on the show, by the way. It's just that's what I pulled because they all seem to be themed. So I thought it'd be a good week for it. But what I found with what this fellow's found is that he's happy to make his property investments and keep that going, but he's shoveling everything he can for the next 5 to 10 years into a diversified portfolio. Because he knows that in 5 to 10 years, he's going to have enough money snowballed in there that he can then rely on it. And a lot of people can can find comfort in that, that 5 to 10 years, shovel it in a few years, you'll be able to rely on it thanks to fully franked dividends, thanks to income from bonds and that sort of stuff. Just for anyone, whether you're in retirement, whether you're approaching retirement, or whether you're younger with kids and you're going through that stage of life, always, always, always have cash. Cash is not an investment, like in the sense of, it might be in your portfolio if you do have that allocation for a reason. But that's an
emotional
separate
brace as well.
Yeah. You need cash outside of investing. That's a separate amount of money. We've probably got time for one more or two more questions, Drew, but this one might take us a while to riff on, so I thought this was a good one, which comes from, and this is the question name. Asking for a friend whose soon-to-be 18-year-old daughter knows everything apart from investing, which is boring because her father is so into it. Says, if you were to buy 4 ETFs with the objective of capital growth, including dividend reinvestment, as well as diversification, what would they be? So we can just, we don't have to do 4, we can do whatever, just some ETFs. They're looking to reinvest those dividends either automatically through their share registry like Link or Computershare, or even just through their own brokerage account. Any ETFs spring to mind?
I think to what we kind of sit within our core, which is slightly different to yours. You've written a few down in here. I don't mind. So when I'm thinking about something long term, I want highly diversified. Mm-hmm. I like the MSCI versus the, you know, the broad global index. Yep. So we use something called IWLD.
Yep.
So iShares.
iWorld.
iWorld, MSCI World, but it has an ESG screen to it, which means it avoids
Green Warrior.
Yeah, Green Warrior. That's exactly. And that's, I think it's relevant because I'm not trying to stereotype here.
Here we go.
The younger generation.
The youngies.
Yeah. The younger generation seems to actually care about what's happening around us.
That's true. At warrenbuffett.com. Send your letters
to Owen. I was saying compared to Owen, not to everyone else.
I am totally unethical.
But they, to reframe that, they find it easier to connect with companies that have ESG. So something that gives consideration, avoids fossil fuels, avoids gambling and tobacco, essentially is what you're saying here.
Yep.
Or what I'm saying, let's put that down to Andrew. So it has an ESG screen. It's also investing into Apple, Nvidia and all the biggest companies in the world, as long as they're, you know, highly rated from an ESG perspective. And it provides a big, diverse exposure. Mm. And has, in the last, I think, 12, 24 months, it's outperformed the S&P because it's cut out a few of those more cyclical sectors.
It's a really good answer. So I didn't expect you to go down that path, but that's really good. I like that. Interestingly, and I agree with you about the stereotype of younger people typically thinking more broadly about that. That's not to say us people without that much hair don't think about it, but I think it is more prominent. And not to talk too much about our own thing, but when we launched our strategy with Rest Invest, we had 3 portfolios and we've got like balanced growth, high growth. But the one thing that's missing from our 3 strategies is an ethical strategy. Yeah. And I think that might turn people off a bit. Like they might want an ethical tilt in their portfolio. So if we do bring in a 4th, it would probably be like you're saying, because for people who do have
within
that
the core,
extra layer, because they want that. And that's totally reasonable. iWorld's a good one because you don't have to pay that much for that overlay.
Yeah.
But some of the ETFs that have
sustainable overlays are more expensive.
They're much more expensive, unnecessarily, in my opinion. So the fact that iShares tracks the MSCI index. MSCI do their own ratings, which is MSCI, by the way, if you've seen that, those 4 letters around. They do their own ratings, which helps with the process. As for me, I mean, any of the normal core ETFs, like IVV, the S&P 500, VAS, Australian, A200 from BetaShares, full disclosure, sponsor our finance podcast. If you're looking for thematic ETFs, I do like the IXJ ETF from iShares, which is a global healthcare.
Yep.
I like that ETF for a long term. It's a thematic / sector ETF. ACDC from GlobalX, which is a battery and supply chain. Full disclosure, GlobalX is a sponsor of this podcast. If you're looking for emerging markets, something like you want to capture Asian growth, there isn't, it's not an ETF, it's an active fund. We use FEMEX, F-M-E-X is the ticker symbol. Has underperformed the past year. It's an active strategy as opposed to a passive strategy. but that's something that people can chuck on their watch list. We obviously don't know your personal circumstances or anything like that. We're just talking about long-term capital growth. I'd be looking for something that invests in shares.
Yep.
I'd be looking for something that has a long-term time horizon, even within the ETF. A lot of people don't think about this, but within the ETF itself, it should be holding the positions for a long time. That's something that we call turnover. And the reason is if you have an ETF that looks growth from the outside, but on the inside it's buying and selling, that's crystallizing tax each and every day, and meaning that your tax statement at the end of the year is going to be brutal. And you don't know until the end of the year what they've done. So look for low turnover ETFs. That's a great question though. And good luck to anyone that's investing for their kids. It's such a wonderful thing.
I'd probably add some real assets or infrastructure to that potentially.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. If they're building a full portfolio, if they can. Yeah. Just hard through ETFs, but you could do it through
It's like VBLD, GLIN, GLPR, VAP. They're kind of, if you think about it, where VAP, other pockets of diversification.
Yeah. Even some of the REITs.
Yeah.
Yeah. They'll do it if they're diversified. Michael wrote in and said, how do I access the 20% discount on Nuvexa through Rask? Michael, you can head to the Rask Media website or you can link in the show notes. There's a link to Nuvexa to track your portfolio for tax. The guys over at Nuvexa are doing a wonderful job based out of Melbourne to track tax for people and help simplify all the reporting. We've probably got time for one more question, Drew. Which one do you like? Maybe there's a lot of superannuation. Did we ask for superannuation questions last week?
I'm not sure. Is it because you shared it with Finance Pod again?
Yeah, maybe.
No, we get this on our own. We don't need.
We have, like, in the last 7 days, we have received dozens and dozens and dozens of questions about superannuation. Clearly, there is something, and it's particularly for retired folks. We are going to, you know what it is? We're doing the retirement series that's coming up in about a month.
Yep.
There is a 8 or 10 part retirement series coming up on this channel. So keep an eye on that. We'll explain why we're doing the retirement series. It's not just for Drew's book, The Golden Years, How to Maximize Your Concessional Contributions. Is that the name of it?
Yes.
Golden Years? Yeah,
it's The Golden Times. The Golden Years is the book. Golden Times is the website. Sorry.
Stumped him.
Golden everything.
Okay. So maybe we'll revert back to one of my questions then for you. Who is the best finance presenter you've ever seen and why?
Best finance presenter.
Could be on the telly, could be.
Oh, this is more recent. Okay. And it was just the energy with this, maybe it's too narrow, maybe because you've stumped me again because I've got to think what I've seen in Australia rather than what I've watched.
Yep.
There's a lady called Chama.
Oh, yeah.
That did our retirement event.
Yeah, down in Melbourne. She was great.
There's also the guys at Australian Eagle. So what I look for is passion in what they're doing because, you know, you can, and maybe that's the wrong thing. Maybe numbers work better than passion. Mm-hmm. But the way some of these people talk without notes and are able to respond to questions, it just comes through and it gives you want to kind of be alongside them investing. So, definitely Chao Ma, and that was when she was investing in China at one point. Now she's investing in smaller companies and the passion for the sectors and her ability to kind of explain that at a level that's appropriate for everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. She was great that day at the Waddle retirement event. Hopefully doing a few more of those this year. Keep an eye out. Okay. So I've got to pick a question, a name to receive the Value Investor program. You've got to come up with a dad joke.
I've forgotten my book. So yeah.
You know what that means, ladies and gentlemen. Keep your questions coming in. Super, retirement, or otherwise. We did get a question from Emergency Highway saying, can you guys do a deep dive on CivMec? That's ASX CVI. And if you can share your views. These are the types of things. If you have companies or if you have ETFs, like the guy who was asking for a friend whose daughter will soon, who knows everything, something, send us your ideas because we can then turn them into full episodes. If you send us an idea for an episode or you send us an idea for a company, we can bundle them all together. We've got Luke coming back up on the show soon. He'll look at some stocks like ProMedicus and a few other businesses. So send us these in, guys. And of course, anyone who got their question read out on the show today gets a copy of Drew's book, The Golden Years. How to not
stuff it up.
Stuff it up. No, it is not that.
For fulfilling and successful retirement, both financially.
Okay.
And
otherwise.
With your lifestyle.
Okay. So that's Drew's book. There's a heap of them sitting in our office just outside the studio here. We will be sending them out later this month. So write into us. Send us your address. The 5 days away. So we can start sending them next week, basically. Yep.
We're done.
Cool. We're done. Send us in. I think the question and name has to go to the person who did say something along the lines of asking for a friend whose soon-to-be 18-year-old daughter, who knows everything apart from investing, which is boring because her father is so into it, write into us. You've just won a Value Investor program. It's the complete guide to value investing. Whether you're investing in shares or ETFs or funds, it has something for everyone. And we'll also give it to your daughter if she does one day get interested. So, Drew, we need your joke.
I had two lined up here. I'm going to go with this one. You're probably going to hate it because it might be singing again.
Oh, what?
What is Beethoven's favorite fruit? A banana.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I don't even...
Thanks for listening to this latest episode of the Australian Best Podcast. That's my best dad joke by far because... Owen is clearly stumped.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to give that like a 3.
Oh.
That, I mean, you got the vocal cords out a little bit, but mate, always a pleasure chatting to you. Hit up Drew at waddlepartners.com.au or the link in your show notes if you are an accumulator looking to get financial advice, mortgage broking, or see where I'm investing. Check out the show notes. It's all there. Drew, as always, absolute pleasure.
Good to see you.
For more than a decade, I've been hunting for the best investors and their methods, strategies, and tools for investing. After years in the industry, countless books, a few degrees, and 1,000 podcasts and live shows, I've rolled this accumulated knowledge into something called Rask Invest. If you've ever heard me talk about a core and a satellite, active and passive, true long-term compounding, or you simply want to know exactly how I would invest, now is your chance. Rask Invest is our new investment service, designed for all types of investors who want professional management of their core portfolio at a low cost from a team they trust. Rask Invest helps you automate your wealth creation and passive income. Simply click the link that says Invest with Owen in your podcast player to join one of our live platform walkthroughs or book a call with us. You can also view the Rask Invest PDS and TMD and get invested with me.